Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is James Stiegel. I'm joined by my co-host, Darylyn Evans. Today, we're talking with epic fantasy author, Jeff Wheeler. Jeff Wheeler took an early retirement from his career at Intel in 2014 to become a full-time author. He is, most importantly, a husband and father, and a devout member of his church. He is occasionally spotted roaming among the oak trees and granite boulders in the hills of California, or in any number of the state's majestic redwood groves. He's the author of 15 books, including the Covenant of Muirwood Trilogy, the Legends of Muirwood Trilogy, the Whisperers from Mirrorwind Trilogy, and the Landmore series. His most recent books are the King Fountain series. Jeff Wheeler, welcome to Sentence to Paragraph.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So is it 15 books since 1999? Is that when you first published your first book?
Yes, 1999. And I've written several books before that, but those were all part of my 1 million words of making mistakes. And none of them have seen the light of day. So the 1999 is kind of when the record begins.
Excellent. Well, 15 since then is a lot, especially with a full-time career and a family. And is it 5 kids?
Yes.
That's wow. How did you carve out time to write?
You know, when I was in college and we didn't have any kids, I had more time. And as each child came along, that time kept shrinking. And finally, what it worked out for my wife and I was we carved out one night a week for, 2 to 3 hours where we said, Wednesday night, this is it. From 7 to 10 p.m., don't disturb me. I'm just going to, I'm just going to write. I'm going to just focus on that. And then I'm not going to write, at all, between those other times. And so kind of setting an earmarked time for that was something that worked out for me. And what was helpful about it is the rest of the week before it was time to write again is when I'd be doing my brainstorming, my thinking about what am I going to write next? What's the next going to be the next chapter? How's that going to go? And so I had lots of, kind of prep time so that when it was time to actually write, it's just fingers on the keyboard typing furiously. And I was able to crank out maybe about a chapter in one setting. And so just week by week, one chapter at a time. And then after so many weeks, you have a novel. So that just kind of worked out for me. So other people, it works differently for them. But for me, just having a dedicated time, even 2 hours, ended up being just, what I needed to be able to keep going.
I'm just curious how you were able to stay focused during that time. Like, what helped you keep your eyes on the prize, basically, to add up those chapters?
Well, something I heard in a writing seminar I attended with Terry Brooks, who's one of my all-time favorite authors. He kind of explained that the craft of writing is kind of like laying tile or something. It's repetitive. It takes a long time to do, and so you kind of have to have that mindset going into it. I don't wait until the inspiration hits me and it's like, oh, there's violins and birds singing and now I write. I write at a certain cadence, at a certain schedule, whether I feel like it or not. And so for me, it's when I set out to be a writer and to write books, I knew that boredom would set in. I knew I might have difficulties, but it's more of a matter of willpower and habits to say, this is how I'm going to do it. And I've found that it's like a muscle that once you develop it, it can produce for you and you can lay tile infinitely, as I have discovered. So
that's a lot. You've done what most writers are hoping to do, and that is leave the day job behind, write full time. You were able to do that in 2014 after, and so 99 to 2014, 15 years of writing, one day a week, and that's pretty amazing. And so you finally leave it behind. How has your writing life changed since then? And that's a pretty big step to make. Like, what kind of bumps did you encounter, or how did you change those habits? And with hope you have more time to write than one day a week now, for 3 hours.
No, it was obviously a stressful decision, one of the reasons it came about is when 47 North, my publisher, picked me up, they bought the books that I was working on at the time, which was the Whispers from Mirrorwind series. I was almost done with the first book of that series. And they also bought the Legends of Muirwood series, which is the one I had self-published before they picked me up. And, when they relaunched Muirwood, the fact that they launched all three books on the same day with, audio and Kindle and print, You know, the sales wow. were, you know, the fact that readers didn't have to wait in between books. And so we saw that was a very interesting model. And so one of the things that I talked about with them is I said, well, after this Mirrorwind series, I'm thinking about going back and writing more Mirrorwind books. Wouldn't it be interesting if we could have a publishing schedule that's closer to the original than this year in between books like we were doing for Whispers? And so they were very intrigued about that. So that was one of the decision points that's like, well, if I'm going to write three books in a year, I'm going to need to do this full time. So we kind of worked out that, you know, kind of the deal terms and stuff to make that happen. So it was kind of an educated risk, but I felt that, you know, I could easily write more than one day a week, but I knew if I was trying to write 5 days a week, it might burn me out. So near the end of that, you know, Covenant of Mirrorwind series, I was, you know, trying to hit my deadline. I was writing like, you know, five chapters a week just for the last, you know, month. And that really started to tap me. And so I saw that, okay, five is too much. Three is perfect for me. So I write Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, three chapters a week, and I'm able to write a book in about 3 months. And so I that's the kind of the cadence that I feel like, you know, it's like a runner's pace. It's like, okay, I can sustain this faster than that, writing more, you know, quickly. I don't think I'm going to be able to sustain that. Just I felt more drained and it was more difficult. So I think I found kind of the optimal cadence for me, which is unlike a lot of other writers, but it's really good for my fans because they don't have to wait 3 years for a series. They get all three books within a couple of months of each other, and then they don't have to wait, and then it works out really well for my publisher because they sell more books that way too.
In conceiving of the book, in, you know, as opposed to writing one each year, maybe in the traditional model, do you find yourself plotting and conceiving where the three novels are more a Lord of the Rings thing, where it's one whole book that's been divided into three parts, or are you, how does that work as far as your plotting process and how you conceive of the book?
That's a really good question. So the way I've been for years is I kind of conceive stories in a kind of a three book story arc. So trilogies is kind of natural for me. And so it's helpful because I kind of know where I'm going to land. I don't know every little detour I'm going to take along the journey. I don't outline the entire thing, but what I do with my publisher is I kind of give them a pitch and I, you know, write a synopsis of, okay, here's what the story's about. Here's where I see the major touching points of the plot for these three books. Here's where I'm going to land so that we can have a discussion about it if they, you know, they're concerned or anything. And they tend to not be. They kind of like my ideas. And so that's what I do. And then as I start on the journey, I'll make detours and things like that. But I always kind of come back to that central story arc that is involved. So that's something I conceive at the very beginning. And it kind of helps me to know where am I going to land, you know, 3 months from now when I'm done writing, you know, book one, and then 6 months from now, book two. And it doesn't, it's not perfect, but it's in the general direction. And although I've made some tweaks and adjustments, I do end up kind of writing towards that vision that I had from the first place. So it really helps me to have that understood in advance.
Could we have you read a little excerpt from Queen's Poisoner?
Yes, I would be happy to do that. And I'm going to start actually on the first part of chapter two, because this is when you get to meet your protagonist, Owen. And, you know, he's an 8-year-old boy who's been, you know, uprooted from his family and, you know, is sent to live with this ruthless king that we know about. This is where you really get to see him from his point of view. And writing from the point of view of an 8-year-old was definitely, you know, going out of my comfort zone a little bit. So let me share a little bit of chapter two with you. Owen loved to play by himself and could entertain himself for hours at a time, whether by stacking tiles in a row before knocking them down, marshaling lead soldiers to war, or reading to himself. He was talkative with his family. When it came to swinging wooden swords with his siblings, he was usually the one who made others cry, even his sisters. But put him in a room with a single stranger, and he would skulk behind a chair and observe the newcomer with wary eyes until he or she left. That was how he watched Lord Horwath. Only when the Duke left Tatton Hall, Orne was riding behind his saddle, terrified and so stricken by surprise that he could not have spoken to anyone if he had tried. As they rode away from his family, his mother's tears glistening on her cheeks, he wondered if he'd ever be able to speak again. Tatton Hall was his world. and he knew the innermost corners of it from basement to garret. There were some parts of the manor he was afraid of. The wine cellar was dark and had a funny smell. But there were secret places that only he knew, places where he could hide himself away and never be found. The gardens were vast, and he had spent countless days enjoying the simple pleasures of running in the grass or resting on beds of leaves to watch the ants and tickle bugs crawl in the earth. He loved how the tickle bugs would coil themselves up into little pebbles that he could roll around on his palm. And then when he held still, their little legs would start squirming again, and they were upright, and he let them crawl around his hand in circles. Owen loved nature and the outdoors, but he loved the indoors even more. Books fascinated him, and the effect that letters had on his eyes was much like the thrill of the tickle bugs on his skin. When he read, it was as if he were transported to some dreamland where he could not hear whispers or shouting. He could read anything and everything he could get his little hands on, and he remembered it all. His hunger for books was never satisfied, and his favorites were stories about the exploits of the Fountain Blessed.
Oh, that's so good. Thank you. What I loved about your new series, this book, is that it incorporates all of that political intrigue and machinations of the War of the Roses, and particularly you're looking at Richard III, and I read a lot of Shakespeare, and so I really felt I was seeing this through the story. But even more interesting, you know, we're watching this. We're watching this through the eyes of Owen, who's 8 years old, the son of a duke, who's being kept by the king as insurance for loyalty. And then we get to watch Owen grow up through this series, and kind of grow into his power, both his magic and his, he starts as a duke. So I just think it was very masterfully done. How did this particular series come about for you?
You know, there definitely is that, that you know, homage to the War of the Roses. When I was a medieval history major in college, got my bachelor's and master's degree at San Jose State, and my master's thesis was on a period during Richard III's reign. And so I've read a lot of the source materials, the historical accounts written from historians back in the 15th century, and read the Shakespeare play, read Thomas More, and read those things. But what I also admitted at the end of, in the author's notes at the end of the book, that is that the story is actually inspired by the book Charlotte's Web, and that, you know, the story of this kind of this runt, you know, who's sent to live at the Zuckerman's farm, or he's going to die. You know, I just thought this would make a great fantasy story. And here's this, you know, the only person who befriends him is this, you know, spider, you know, who's dangerous. Right. And I just, this idea came together of retelling that story in the setting of the War of the Roses. But you see, that's how creativity, at least for me, it happens.
Oh, wow.
You get two different ideas and then you kind of smash them together and they kind of just ferment, and then these new ideas come together. So you know, that's how many authors and many stories get created, is just this collision of two different ideas. And so that's where book one came from. That's where The Queen's Poisoner came from. And I loved being able to go back to, you know, I rewatched as many of the Shakespeare plays as I could. Went back to some of the books that I had, you know, read in college, and just kind of, you know, immersed my mind in all the details of that time. And so it just kind of almost wrote itself. It was so much fun to do.
So, oh my gosh, I had missed the Charlotte's Web thing altogether, and that I think is brilliant. So I love that idea. So what about the magic system in particular? Like, how did you, it sounds like that would be something that would take quite some time. The kind of that plot and mashup that's going on, but then also kind of thinking up this new magic system, because you have a pretty comprehensive one over in Muirwood, and then in Mirrowin. So
it's a different one there. So
yeah.
So
what kinds of magic? Where is that coming from?
You know, for when I'm creating a new world, and I'm you know, not just making a map and not just coming up with the politics and stuff, I try to look for ideas of what inspires me. So, you know, part of it came from the fact that, you know, before I started writing Queen's Poisoner, my wife and I took an anniversary getaway to Yosemite, and the waterfalls were just full. And you know, hiking the trails around the, you know, the tops of these waterfalls and standing, you know, really, you know, just to see the power of the water and just to watch it come and just this never ending flow. So that was part of the inspiration. But another thing that inspired it was a TED talk actually that I watched years ago by this guy who talks about this concept called flow, which is, you know, creative. So you're not in your head, I think, and kind of it makes sense, right? You when an artist or a writer or an engineer is in kind of enmeshed in their craft or whatever they're working on, they experience where the challenge is just perfect. And, you know, there's the challenge and the difficulty and the time. There's this kind of the sweet spot that you get into where, like, time seems to stop. And you just get into the state where you just flow. And that's what he called it. And I can't even pronounce the guy's name. It's kind of tricky. But I remember watching that TED Talk. And as I watched it, I said, that's what it's like for me when I'm writing a book. That one day a week that I was writing, when I go into that, you know, my den, and I shut the door and I put on my headphones and I start writing, I go into this flow state and it just, the words just come and the story just comes. That's exactly how it described it. It feels like that for me when I'm playing the piano. And I know other people that have that same thing. So I kind of borrowed that element, that psychological phenomenon of when you're challenged just at the right level, it unleashes something inside of you. And so that's kind of where it came from. I said, well, let me do that. And then I married that onto the Arthurian legends of the Lady of the Lake, right? And things like that. So just all these couple of these pieces, again, I kind of mushed them together and said, the fountain blessed, these people who use the magic, this fountain magic, are those few individuals that have learned to kind of, you know, they've kind of dedicated themselves to something and are able to gain power from it, that we all have the ability to, but very few actually dedicate the time necessary to master something. And so that's kind of where the idea came from. It's never one idea, as you see. It's right. Just, it's, for me, it's always creativity is about mixing together certain elements and then seeing those things. And in fact, there was a line from that Richard III play from Shakespeare that talked about, you know, one of the characters talked about having this vision as he was asleep of being plunged under the water and seeing all these treasures and stuff under the water. And as I was rereading and watching the plays, I'm like, that's brilliant. I love that. It's like this throwaway thing that Shakespeare did. I snatched it and said, I'm using this. This is good stuff.
So when you do your world building, do you kind of let it come out organically as you're writing, or do you take it, you know, kind of write extensive notes before you sit down to actually start writing?
Great question. I'm kind of a hybrid myself. So I, you know, a lot of the stuff happens just inside my head. So I've had that book. I had Queen's Poison in my head for several years before I ever wrote it down. So I had kind of some scenes. I had, you know, the characters were kind of fermenting in my mind before I ever even started writing them. So that's part of my process, is I just, you know, I'm thinking about what I'm going to write next while I'm writing the thing I'm writing now. And I always write some notes and story ideas. I'll email them to myself just to kind of keep them fresh. But I don't extensively plot out or outline what I do. So other than doing the synopsis at the beginning, I don't really write out, here's this chapter, here's that chapter. I kind of let the mood guide me towards where we need to be. And the fact that I'm writing a couple days in advance, the days that I don't write, I'm thinking about the next chapter that I'm going to write. And so that kind of helps me go, where's the next step I need to take in the story, and what are some things I can throw together, and what cliffhanger did I leave them off at the end of the chapter that I now need to, you know, move forward into the next chapter. So it's kind of a hybrid, but more just dwelling on things in my head. I don't have, you know, I'm more inspired by pictures than I am by, you know, writing stuff down. So I have on my computer a folder full of images that are places that have inspired me, or images like of waterfalls or fountains or things like that have inspired me.
So I guess the next question, because I'd had, when you're conceiving the books in three parts, you would say you're writing in a linear manner. Then you're not jumping around within the plot. You know, you're starting from A and working to B, C, D, and E.
Absolutely. I never write ahead chapters. I always, you know, just move one chapter at a time, whether I've Sometimes I'm excited. Oh, I can't wait to write this chapter. It's five chapters from now. I don't let that enthusiasm rush me to it. I'm very methodical. I'm just, no, it's this next piece of the tile comes next, and then this one, and this one, and then I'll write that chapter I'm looking forward to writing. So very linear, absolutely.
Owen with his tiles.
Exactly.
So can you talk about how you develop characters then, and how if you're working on a linear, you know, hey, I know where I want this to go, you know, how do you develop characters, and then how do you let the characters potentially, you know, push on the plot and vice versa to make it feel organic?
Well, at the risk of sounding schizophrenic, the characters kind of live in my head. And as I can, you know, as I either, you know, like for example, Owen, I actually live with him. He's based on one of my kids. And so some of his anxiety, that fear, you know, he's the most outgoing kid, will whack his brother with a lightsaber, but a stranger walks in the house and he clams up and will hide in the corner and won't come out. And so some of those idiosyncrasies in those quirks, sometimes I'm inspired by real people. Sometimes it's just pure fantasy, you know, things that I've made up in my head. So as authors, we all get our inspiration from different things. But for the most part, these characters have been walking around in my head long before I start writing the story. And so I kind of get, you know, and when I think about, you know, who do I want to, you know, to base this on, or what, you know, and how can I make them grow, over, you know, during the course. I think the biggest surprise for me came in the character of Elizabeth Victoria Mortimer, because, you know, when I was talking to my publisher about this book, they said, you know, you have this little boy, how is this going to work, you know, and I thought, you know, he's going to have the poisoner as his friend, but he needs somebody his age, and I kind of needed somebody to come up with. And so, true story. So I was actually looking through my own, you know, family history, my own genealogy, because I have an ancestor who fought in the Battle of Bosworth Fields, where Richard III died. Right. So my own family history, he was one of the generals of Richard III, actually. And so I went and I looked at his line, and I was looking for, did he have a granddaughter that was around the age of 8 years old around this time? And it turns out that he did. Her name was Elizabeth Mortimer. And oh, so wow. I'm like, perfect. And then, you know, Victoria comes in because it's actually based on a little girl who I would drive to school with my kids every morning. And she would talk about building fish tanks in the middle of houses. And just, she was such a talker. And she's just the cutest little thing. And so literally she came to my rescue to become that character. And I just love the interplay that, you know, Owen and Evie had in the story, and it was so fun to write. So sometimes they're based on, you know, people that I'm very familiar with, and sometimes it's just fiction. I just make these people up.
The voice actor in the audiobook did a really great job with her. It's such a joy to listen to your dialogue through the actor.
Kate Rudd has narrated most of my books. She did not do the Mirrorman series, but she's done like all the others, and I insist on her every time just because she's amazing. So. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend listening to her versions. She does a great job, you know, emoting the character and making it real.
So can you talk about what attracts you to fantasy? You know, obviously, have you been writing fantasy from the beginning, or did you come on a path to fantasy? Are there certain themes that you want to explore, or is there, you know, is that just what you're drawn to?
You know, there's two answers to the question. So for me, the desire to become a writer sparked when I was in middle school and I read, you know, one of Terry Brooks's Shannara books. And that, I can trace back to the time when that kind of like lit a match inside my head, right? I wanted to be a writer. But the first books that I wrote, the practice novels, were actually more thrillers, you know, and, you know, more mystery thriller kind of things. And it wasn't until later that I said, you know, I want to go back to, you know, kind of epic fantasy. And so I wrote, you know, Lanmore and did that while I was in college. So I, you know, I'd written some thrillers, some historical, you know, kind of some historical fiction as well. And I kind of threw all that aside and then decided to go, you know, strictly with fantasy. So it maybe I came back to my first love in a way, mm-hmm. but, you know, that a lot of the books I've written originally were just kind of a different genre. And I kind of settled with fantasy because what I love about it is I don't have to follow rules, and I don't have to I get to create the rules to follow for myself, and I kind of like that freedom to be able to do that. I thought about writing historical novels, but I hated being constrained by history. And even The Queen's Poisoners are retelling what would have happened if Richard III didn't die at the Battle of Bosworth Field. How would have England been different if he had stayed the king and had defeated Henry Tudor? And that, to me, that just opened up all these possibilities just to try out something new with a cast of characters who I knew were alive at his time, and how could I play them off against each other? So
where do you feel your writing fits in terms of young adult, adult, you know, so and I guess I ask because, you know, with the Muirwood books with, again, the first book of Queen's Poisoner, you're following a fairly young protagonist, although in Queen's Poisoner we're going to see him grow up and grow into his own. Where do you fall in that, and what were you, why did you choose those particular places, which who to write for?
You know, it's a really good question. And when I wrote the Legends of Muirwood series, you know, I was kind of imagining in my mind that I was writing for mothers and daughters, right? Because I thought, you know, I want something that, you know, an adult would enjoy reading and want to share with their kid too. So I want it to be clean so that it's, you know, both audiences could do it. And what's absolutely surprised me is that I get emails from, you know, single men, grandfathers, 10-year-olds. I mean, my audience is really about as wide as it can be. And it's totally surprised me because I was kind of targeting one market, and it just, I guess, you know, it's just appealed to so much more. So I love, you know, having, you know, I just did a book signing this last weekend, and I, you know, a family came in, and the kids loved it, and the parents loved it. And so it's like, okay, that was the market I was writing for. I just didn't really realize it, you know, that it wasn't just limited to, you know, young women, but, you know, young men have liked it as well as all ages groups. So I've kind of forgotten about who I'm writing for, and I'm mostly just telling the stories that I want to tell, and, you know, trying to, you know, push myself as well as, you know, and write something that's interesting to me as well. So I, you know, writing about an 8-year-old boy, I'm like, wow, this is totally outside of what I've done in the past. And I wondered, is my audience going to follow me there? You know, as I go to King Fountain, it's kind of taking a risk. And even my publisher realized this is taking a risk. Well, it's absolutely the best risk I could have taken, because King Fountain has outsold Muirwood just about. So clearly it's had a larger audience and invited even more people to come in and learn about my books and stuff. So absolutely great thing to do, to take that risk. I don't regret it for a second.
How was it managing that feeling of risk when you were writing, and did that, like, how did that throw you, or did it? And then how did you kind of push through that so it didn't stop you from writing a great book?
You know, an idea that I had as I started writing Queen's Poisoner to help manage the risk specifically. So most authors are assigned by their publisher a development editor, right? It's the dev editor is what they're called. And so I've been working with the same, you know, dev editor for the last couple of years, and, you know, especially working on with, you know, starting through in the Covenant of Muirwood series. And so I suggested to my you know, editor at 47 North, I said, you know, why don't, instead of waiting to bring the dev editor on when I'm done writing book one, how about we bring her on when I'm about a third of the way done and let her have a first peek at what's going on, and just, and I'll share it with you and I'll share it with her, and let's just see how things are going. And, you know, that first, you know, they said, yeah, let's give it a try. So we did that, and the feedback was so positive. It's like, absolutely, this is working. This is, and it kind of helped relieve some of that anxiety that, for me to say, I'm not writing the entire book before I get, you know, this professional feedback, but I start getting it early on, and nothing changed in terms of, I was able to continue my process the way I normally did. And just, you know, by the time we were done with the book, we were totally safe with that. So that we didn't even need to use that for book two, for Thief's Daughter. They were said, you know, Jeff, we trust you. You nailed this one. We loved it. Let's just keep writing this series. And so we did that to mitigate the risk a little bit. But as I was writing it, I was having this feeling like, this is special. This is going to be a neat book. And I think my readers are really going to like this series, and it's definitely turned out to be the case.
Well, I think you definitely captured that emotional roller coaster of being young, and you know, that angst that especially the little boy feels. And you said you drew that from your own son, but also in Muirwood, you've captured her angst. I mean, I really was feeling for her being this orphan and not being able to, you know, read. She's being kept from reading and from learning her magic, and I was just right there with her. In all of that angst, how did you connect to her, and all of that emotional roller coaster?
That's a question I hear so much. It's like, okay, how's a 40-year-old guy channeling a 13-year-old girl? I don't understand how this is happening. So let me explain a little bit. So I at the time I was writing the Legend of Muirwood series, I was a youth group leader in my church. And so I was interacting with teenagers regularly and seeing, I mean, some of the little pettiness that these characters have with each other was taken from real life, where I would watch them do these things to each other. So, you know, I love to people watch. And so I don't need to go to the mall, because just through my church, I get to see a lot. Right now, one of my assignments in church is I teach teenagers, you know, religion classes Monday through Friday at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I'm with teenagers every day, in addition to having a house with three teenagers. So I kind of get it. But as I was writing, the Legends of Muirwood series, I had a niece who was 16 at the time, and she was one of my early readers. And so I would literally send her a couple of chapters at a time, you know, like once a month I'd send her, you know, four chapters, because I'd written that many at the time. And I would just ask for her reaction. It's like, am I hitting the tones right? And then I would ask her after she would read it, I'd say, what do you think she's going to do next? You know, what kind of concerns do you have? What are you thinking? And I'd get that feedback from somebody. And it's kind of cute, because my niece, Jenna, had very crinkly blonde hair, which, you know, I based the character Leah off of. And I dedicated the book to her as well. And so she was kind of my resident teenage girl that helped me through the process as I was writing that book, just to make sure I was hitting the right chords and making it believable. And I really appreciate what she did, because it helped me, I think, capture that a lot better than I could have on my own.
We all need a teen consultant.
It's true.
So are you a member of any writers groups, or do you just seek out these sort of subject matter experts? Or are you working with anyone else besides the dev editor as part of your process?
My process is I actually have a core group of people that I share my writing with. So the closest core is my youngest sister. She actually gets to read my stuff every week. Every week I send her the chapters that I've written for that week. And so for her, it's like this water torture. It's like I'm waterboarding her, where every week she only gets three chapters and then she's got to wait another week. So it's torture for her, but she gladly accepts the torture. So she gets it. My wife and my daughter are also part of my first readers. So they get to read stuff even more regularly. And then when I'm done, I have a handful of people that I've known for years. I trust their input. They read lots of books. They read, you know, cross multiple genres. And so I send the book when I'm done, I send it to these first readers before I even send it to my editor. And so what I'll do is I'll collect all of their feedback, and I really won't change much. I'll send it to my editor and to my dev editor, and then I'll include their comments in an email, and I'll say, here's what my first readers, you know, looked at. And so that feedback, I think, is really helpful, because it allows it's kind of data, right, for my my publisher to say, here's how the audience is reacting to the story kind of real time as it goes on. And then my dev editor and my editor give me their feedback, and then we start the revision process from there. But that's how I do it. And I really think having some early readers is very valuable. But I'm not part of any writers groups. These are all people that have kind of pulled around myself, kind of a team that, you know, I can count on. They've not, you know, published my book on the internet or something like that I'd be really afraid of. You know, that's what I do. I know a lot of people do writers groups that I was part of that earlier on in my process, but I found having a core group of people was the most helpful for me.
With that, so early on, and then I guess now, what do you do you know, like, what did you do early on if you're not part of writers groups to kind of, you know, improve your craft? Were you taking classes? Was it reading books? And, you know, you've already mentioned your million words, and of course that's absolutely necessary, lots of reading and writing, but what other outside things did you have any really key things that helped you improve your craft?
You know, when I was in college, I took as many creative writing classes as I could, and some were more helpful than others. But to be honest, for me, working on the craft has been more about reading. It's read, then write, and then read some more, and then write some more. So I always have books that I am devouring, whether it's business books, biographies, fantasy, other kinds of genres too. I try not to just limit myself. I think for me, that to develop the craft of writing, you need to see what makes other things tick. So I, for example, I mentioned, you know, being over this youth group, and, you know, several years ago, all the teenage girls were raving about Stephanie Meyer's Twilight books, and they were all reading them. And you know, I wasn't interested in reading a story about, you know, a vampire. That wasn't interesting to me at all. But the fact that everyone was so absorbed by it, I'm like, I got to read this thing. I got to understand what it is. And so part of the process is to read other books, and especially, you know, bestsellers and stuff, and to kind of read it with a critical eye. Read it to say, okay, how are they hitting the emotional chords? Because that's really what we're doing as writers. We're playing emotional chords, like a piano piece almost. So how are they doing this? How are they creating these chords and trying to understand? And so when I'm reading a book, I'm always analyzing it while I'm reading it, especially if I feel something. It's like, wow, why did I feel that? And I've been reading a Charles Dickens book right now, and this chapter just totally made me feel. And I'm like, okay, why is that? I stopped, I pushed pause, and I analyzed what about this scene was resonating with me. As I thought about it, okay, now I know. I kind of reverse engineered it and said, okay, now I understand that. And I really think that's one of the best advices I've ever heard from an author. And the advice I try to give to people is just read a lot and understand what is it that they're doing. Is this popular because they're copying somebody else? Or how are they evoking emotions in you? And try to understand that and try to, you know, kind of, you know, dissect it, take it apart. And then it kind of teaches you those principles. And I've heard many other authors use very similar advice. And it's what's worked for me. It's just reading a ton is helped kind of help me, you know, understand how to do the craft better than taking a ton of writing seminars and stuff, which might teach you about, I found all that stuff kind of confuses me. You know, when you write, when you try to write and you have all these rules going in your head about you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do, I just throw all that stuff out the window and I just write. And then as I come back and I edit it, I'll look at it through a more critical eye and I'll start tweaking things and figuring out. But I think you can sometimes paralyze yourself and not even write a word because of all the stuff you hear about what to do or not to do. I just say, throw all that stuff away and just write. And you can edit it later and fix it. Trust me, there's lots of edits that happen down the road that can fix the problems that, you know, you might have based on all the rules of the, you know, the people have come up with.
You can't edit a blank page.
Exactly.
Well, and that's where I think, you know, having a group of trusted people can be more useful than a writer's group sometimes, because it really seems that writers read in a very different way than, you know, readers do. And that can be stifling to the process.
I agree with that.
So, you know, in talking about books that in the reading you've done, do you have anything, especially as a contemporary fantasy author, is there any fantasy that you really think of as your canon, or the place that, you know, you really took a lot of inspiration from?
You know, it would have to be like, for me, some of the things that have really inspired me the most were Terry Brooks' Shannara series. I started on the second book. I didn't even know about the first book. I started on the second book.
Oh, wow.
And that's why it's probably will always be my favorite. In grade school, I read The Chronicles of Prydain by Lloyd Alexander. That's kind of a go-to thing. I didn't read The Belgariad until college. David Eddings, you know, influenced me. Margaret Weiss, Tracy Hickman, you know, they inspired me while I was in high school. So there's kind of some core things that did, but I've also very much been inspired by history. And, you know, I don't try to just limit, you know, my creativity to one genre. I really think you can learn. You can, like I said, you can write fantasy book based on Charlotte's Web. You know, there's lots of different ways you can draw your inspiration for ideas. So don't limit it to just to one, you know, to one subject. But I've always been attracted to good writing, and I've loved, you know, some of the British authors like Charles Dickens and, you know, Jane Austen and others. I read good stuff, and if I don't like something, I'll stop reading it right away. I won't make it past the first chapter if I don't like it. If it's not speaking to me, I feel like I have only so many years on this planet. I want to fill my brain full of things that I love, not just, you know, snacks, you know, that I, why do I eat that? You know, I'd rather focus on something that I really like, and I'm very picky with books that I read all the way to the end.
How many books do you read a week or a month?
You know, I don't really know that answer. I know I read 4 or 5 at a time. So
oh, wow.
I've got a book on CD in my car. I've got my Kindle. I've got books on my nightstand. I have books on my phone. And so depending on where I am, I might, oh, I'll pick up this book again. So I'm reading like 4 different books right now, and each one I'll finish at a different time. So I definitely spread my mind around multiple sources depending on where I am at the moment. But I love LibriVox, where you can download a classic. You know, I've listened to just, you know, dozens of classics just for free through LibriVox, you know, just on my phone. So I like to look at, you know, I always like to feed the beast, as they say, to come up with, you know, to keep reading other things and to look at classics, because they're classics for a reason. And so even though they might not be popular with today's audiences, something made them last hundreds of years. Okay, why? And then try to understand those things. I really like to go dissect the classics, and invariably doing so will give me another book idea for something else that I might want to write in the future.
I want to back up just a tick. You were talking about, of course, you write a chapter. Well, now you're writing 3 chapters a week, and sending them off to your readers. When does editing happen for you, and what is your editing process like?
Great question. So, editing for me, I will usually stop either a third of the way through, like once a month, or maybe a month and a half, and I'll go back and I'll start reading from the beginning. And I'll read, you know, all the way up to that point, and it maybe takes me a week or something, just because that really helps me to get the flow of the story. How, you know, writing something just one chapter at a time, you don't get a good sense of flow until you've actually sat down and read it. And the book I just finished, which is coming out, you know, next year, I actually didn't even stop to reread it until I actually finished it, and then I read it from the beginning. And that's my editing process, is that then I read it as a reader, you know, and I'll start fixing stuff. And then, because I know once I farm it out to all my other first, you know, early readers, they'll send me typos and things that I missed. It goes through multiple rounds of editing with my publisher. So I don't even spend a lot of my brain cells trying to make sure I understand this comma rule properly, because I don't understand it properly. I was a history major, not an English major, and there are 5 other people who are going to catch it downstream. So I don't try to catch that stuff. I really will look at choices of words, and should I add a little phrase? Should I remove this sentence? Should I cut this paragraph? I do a little bit of trimming, and then that's it. I'm at the point where I don't need to do a lot of like hacking through the foliage. I've whittled away part of that just through the years, and I write a little bit more efficiently now than I did before.
Can we talk about some of the tools that you use to write? Are you primarily on a computer? Are there certain programs that you use, or do you draft in a notebook, et cetera?
You know, I have written my books on Microsoft Word. I have friends that are trying to say, you should try Scrivener, you should try some of this other stuff. You know, I just need something that, you know, can hold the document, and I find Word to be the most efficient for me, and that's what I use. So I don't have lots of, a lot of people keep lots of notes and stuff. I don't. It's mostly in my head, and so you know, I like the fact that, you know, having a publisher, one of the things that the line editors provide is a list of all the words, like the made up words that I've done. So they actually compile that list for me. So it's like, well, how do I spell that person's name? I know I can go check. And I know that even if I get it wrong, I spell my own character's name wrong, they'll catch it downstream, which they're really good at. So I tend to mostly just write, and you know, I don't use a lot of tools. I have a notebook of names. For example, like if I'm driving somewhere and I see a license plate or a bumper sticker or the name of a town or the name of a river, I'll shoot myself a note and I'll add it onto this notebook that it has. Because, you know, this is fantasy, so you need to come up with names all the time. But I'll have this kind of ongoing list of names that I would look at. Or sometimes I'll just be inspired, you know, by something in history or something else that I'll model it after. So tool-wise, Google and my notebook and my brain, that's most of the tools that I have.
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
So how do you manage the business of being author Jeff Wheeler versus the writing life of author or of Jeff Wheeler? Managing that business side of you and the writing. And in your case, the publisher Jeff Wheeler, because you do Deep Magic. You are the publisher for Deep Magic.
Well, you know, I spent 22 years at Intel. And so I have very much a business brain. So in addition to getting a degree in history, I actually got an MBA working for Intel. And so I've always been fascinated by the business model of the publishing industry. And I love reading articles about it. I love watching how things have changed since, you know, e-readers, you know, the Kindle and other, you know, electronic readers. And we're definitely watching a transformation of the industry go on, very, very similar to what we watched with the music industry when, you know, Apple created the iPod. We're absolutely seeing changes come with that. I love the publishing industry. So, you know, you mentioned that I do Deep Magic. So I Deep Magic is something I started doing 10 years ago. You know, I began publishing a monthly, you know, PDF e-zine, you know, publishing stories from authors all over the world. And that was before social media. That was before, you know, a lot of these tools that existed. And so I found that took away a lot of time from my writing. And so we finally shut it down after a couple of years. And so one of the things I decided to do this year was to restart that again. And so the business, I love the fact that, you know, there you have social media and Twitter and all these different things that help you, you know, connect with readers all over the world. I like the fact that, you know, the Kindle platform, that's what we use for Deep Magic, is that people all over the world can download copies of this. I mean, that was so hard 10 years ago to be, that stuff didn't even exist back then. So I love the how the business now makes it possible to do those things. I love that I can go outsource the copy editing to the same folks that, you know, copy edit my stuff. It's all outsourced to contractors now. So, you know, cover arts and stuff like that, it's all outsourced. So I know the business side now, working with my publisher. I know who these people are and how to engage their services to get stuff done. So the business actually fascinates me. And the fact that, you know, while I'm asleep, somebody in Europe is buying one of my books or one of my magazines. And so the fact that this, you know, the business enables it to happen 24/7 is actually really cool. So it's really a good time to be in publishing right now and to see the changes, and it's changing. So even what happened, you know, how I was discovered by 47 North doesn't happen that same way anymore very often, but rest assured, a new way will be invented as the industry continues to adapt to these changes. But I love the fact that you can have readers all over the world now, and that you're not constrained just to one market, that, you know, fans from anywhere can find you and pick you up. And here's a weird fact for you. I sell more copies of my English versions of my books in Germany than I do of the German versions of my books. So,
wow.
Okay, it's fine. It's just, that's just part of the nature of publishing, that people sometimes want to read it in the language it was originally written in. That's okay too.
So we have a question about what keeps you writing, and it sounds like you got a lot of excitement about the industry and just writing in general right now.
Well, I think, you know, hanging out with lots of authors now, you know, rubbing shoulders with my peers that I haven't been able to do before. There's something about us. We all have stories in our heads, like, all the time. So, you know, I'll talk to, you know, teenagers or something, will ask about writing. It's like they have these story ideas. And you can just see, it's like, you've got it. Yeah, you've got it bad. You have to tell stories. So for me, it's like my brain doesn't stop coming up with new ideas. It's like, I don't know how to turn that part off, nor would I want to turn that part off. So definitely, I still have many stories left to tell and ideas in my, you know, I have a little folder in my Gmail account for book ideas that when I'm done with the series I'm working on now, I can go over there and you know, kick around and say, oh, what do I want to do next? I got lots of ideas and still getting new ideas. So what keeps me doing it is my brain, and I love it. I love being able to connect with readers. I love being able to, you know, meet a need that the readers have, right? They want to read new stories. They want to read cool stuff. So I think it's a great win-win situation because I like reading stuff too.
Do you have a sense of, I guess, what questions you want to answer as a writer or what your obsessions are, particular themes that you return to or particular subject matter that you return to in your writing?
Absolutely. So years ago, I watched a talk by Simon Sinek. You've probably seen it. It's the question of why. Why do you do things? And he draws, you know, three circles. That's all he does, the three circles. But then he walks you through this just this brilliant analysis of trying to understand why do you do what you do. So I watched that talk years ago, and it made me stop and think, you know, like, okay, why do I do that? And I actually wrote on my blog a post that I've kind of saved called A Manifesto on Virtue. Mm-hmm. Because as I've analyzed the kinds of stories, whether it's fantasy or whether it's, you know, Shakespeare or whether it's, you know, Dickens or whatever it is, what appeals to me are these, you know, virtus themes. Virtus is the Roman Latin word that means virtue, it means strength, it means fidelity, it means loyalty. It has lots of different words built into it. And it's about self-sacrifice. That's why I've always loved the Star Wars movies, you know, these characters willing to sacrifice themselves for the greater good. It's why I loved Harry Potter. It's why I, you know, love the Hunger Games, you know, a character willing to sacrifice herself for her sister and things like that. So that's what I write about. Those are the themes that continue to inspire me. And that's what kind of gets me up, you know, and makes me want to tell another story. And so as I look through history, as I look through other things, it's those virtus themes, those virtuous themes that just resonate with me. And it resonates with my readership too, because I love getting emails from fans saying, not only did I enjoy your book, but I learned something about myself. It made me want to be a better person because I read your book. And that's just, wow. I love hearing that because it feels like I'm doing just a little bit of good in this world. And so that's what motivates me and that's what keeps me going. And that's why I like fantasy, but it's not just limited to fantasy because those themes are throughout literature in many ways and forms.
Well, I think we've almost hit the end of our time. So we do have one question that we like to ask at the end, which I'm looking around here for. Darylynn, do you have it?
I have it. Okay. So what we like to ask is for each interviewee to give us a little spot of inspiration for writers who are striving to master their craft, that last piece of wisdom that you might want to leave them with. Or the best piece of advice you've ever received, or quote that drives you, anything like that.
Well, I've got two quotes for you because I collect quotes. I am a voracious quote collector. I have hundreds, and there's two that really kind of almost rise to the top of the stack that I think would be good advice for a new writer especially. First one is by Aristotle. He said, or he wrote, because I don't think anybody heard him say it, but he wrote, "We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit." And I love that quote because becoming a good writer is really a habit, right? It's doing something over and over and over again, and you just get better through the act of it. And it becomes a habit. Writing is a habit to you. The other quote is by a Roman philosopher named Ovid. And when I read this one, when I came across this one, it really spoke to me, and I love it. He said this: "A new idea is delicate. It can be killed by a sneer or a yawn. It can be stabbed to death by a quip and worried to death by a frown on the right man's brow. And I've always loved that because really new ideas are delicate. And I think that, you know, when I get a new idea, I actually write it down, I email it to myself to preserve it, right? To kind of protect it. Because if I shared it with somebody right away and they went, that stinks, that's not a good idea. Well, then it could kill the idea before it even gets a chance. And so for me, sometimes I feel like we creatives need to kind of nurture the idea and kind of just let it sit in our brains for a little while and just kind of let it brew for a little while and let it develop. And then it becomes something. And so almost like when I'm writing a book, like The Queen's Poisoner, I almost feel like the story's already written in some parallel dimension or something, and I'm just bringing it out. I'm just releasing it like a sculpture, kind of tapping away at stone. There's something already there, but I'm just putting words around something that's always existed. And so it's so important to protect those ideas because now people are able to enjoy it and now people can see it. But if you don't protect that idea, then it's never going to see the light of day. And then it's never going to change anybody. It's never going to touch anybody. So I love those two quotes because they're what keep me going. It's the habit. And then it also feeds the creativity part of you never know when that new idea is going to turn into a best-selling novel or something. So don't kill it. Don't step on it. You know, protect it, right? And let it go. And I'm so glad that I heard those quotes because it's helped influence me. So good. Glad you have that at the end because it's inspiring to think about those two ideas. And so, you know, another talk to watch is Brené Brown's In the Arena. Mm-hmm. Great talk on how to deal with the slings and arrows of critics.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are only a few people's opinions who actually matter. The rest are just opinions. Yeah. So I love hearing, you know, I like my early readers because they're honest with me. Mm-hmm. And they tell me when things aren't working and they tell me why. And they give me a suggestion of what to do to make it better. They're not like just, you know, fanboys and fangirls like, job. It's like, no, they tell me what's working, what's not. That's helpful. But, you know, you go read your reviews out on the internet and, you know, there are people who hate your stuff and there's people who love your stuff. And it's like, well, you're always going to have a variety of opinions.
Right.
But there's certain opinions, and I usually find it from fellow authors that tend to matter more. You know, people who've actually, you know, who make live or die decisions based on writing, it tends to weigh more than another person who just reads books.
Wow, I feel so inspired just from listening to that. I mean, the whole interview's been great, but that was amazing. Thank you so much for that.
Yes.
So, how can readers and adoring fans find you?
You know, if you type Jeff Wheeler on Google, most places it's going to take you to my blog, which is jeff-wheeler.com, or the second hit, or the first hit, depending on what day you look at it, it'll be my Amazon author page. Those are the two top results that come up when you type Jeff Wheeler. I usually send people either of those places because that way you can find a little bit about my background and then the books that I've done. I write lots of different series, and so one series might appeal to one person more than another person. So I don't write everything just based in one world. I like having a variety of different offerings to do, but those are the two places that I would recommend finding you.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye-bye.